we would take comfort in the fact that you and your sovereignty have sustained your church for whom Christ has died. We pray all this in his name. Amen. All righty. So, what have we covered so far in this course? We've looked at the emergence of the American Presbyterian identity flowing out of the Westminster Reformation in England. You'll note there that Presbyterianism sort of fails in that sense to actually be implemented on a national level in the Church of England. We see that the church in Scotland is able to practice Presbyterianism. They're sort of unhindered from the Church of England and the king in England being able to force episcopacy. That's that other structure of church government with a top-down type system. You have a bishop, an archbishop, a more top-down approach to church government. And we see that there's waves of immigrants that make their way to the U.S. Not at that time. They make their way to the New World. We see the foundations of American Presbyterianism's really at the start of the 18th century. We see some early Presbyterian churches form, a presbytery forms, a national group sort of joins together. We saw the American Revolution, or I skipped over the American Revolution, and today I'm skipping over the Civil War in a sec. But again, we start to see this question of where is our doctrine going to come from? We see that in the Adopting Act. Remember, there's this question of revival in these centuries prior to what we're covering today. We have the old side, new side split over the First Great Awakening. We have the old school, new school split in the Second Great Awakening. We see Princeton Theological Seminary start to take shape, and that's going to be really important for the story today. We start to see how seminaries now really start to factor into the American Presbyterian story. Charles Hodge, that figure we looked at, sort of that pinnacle figure of the old school American Presbyterian tradition. We looked at that controversial figure of Charles Finney and his place and his role in the American Presbyterian Church and sort of the disruptions that he causes in his own ministry. So where are we going today? I said this last time, I am not a big fan of military history, so we're going to skip the Civil War. Sort of like with the American Revolution and this, the military and political side is interesting, but there's also, in our limited time, I really want to focus our attention on the church in this particular era. So again, to bring us up into the timeline, we're looking now at the late 19th century. We're in the 1860s. You'll note there's big divisions in the country on this question of slavery. The Civil War ensues, and we see that the Presbyterian Church splits along northern and southern lines. So in the northern context, we have the PCUSA. It's not really called that yet, but it's kind of that, but you can sort of keep that in your mind. So the Presbyterian Church in the United States of America. And then in the south, the church there is the PCUS, the Presbyterian Church in the United States. So one letter of difference, but a big, big difference between the two churches. And here we start to see the formation of a liberal and a conservative divide. And I want to be clear here in this section too, when I'm going to use these terms liberal and conservative or progressive and conservative, I'm not speaking in sort of modern contemporary political terms. So you don't want to sort of import in our own day's context of how one formulates their ideas on being a progressive or being a liberal versus being a conservative. We're using these terms purely in a theological sense. So there is overlap between the political context of the day and the church context of the day, but here, for our purposes, when I use those terms, I'm speaking purely in a theological manner. Does that make sense? Okay. So we start to see this divide among liberal and conservatives, not in terms of the political, but in terms of the theological. Civil War, we have the split. The major division in the country is this question of slavery. It's being debated in the nation. The end result, as we all know, would come to fruition in the Civil War. This, in turn, did affect the church, not just the Presbyterians, but the church at large. And in the case of Presbyterianism, there was a split. There's the old school and new school divisions that we've seen previously. And now you can almost camp these into northern and southern as well. So not only do you have a northern church and a southern church, you have old school and new school components in both of the churches. Does that make sense? So you can have a southern tradition and have new schoolers in that southern church and old schoolers in the southern church. And the same is true in the north. And we're going to start to see that this morning, especially when we look primarily at the north. So both have old school and new school elements, and this ultimately leads to division in both the north and the south. So further division in the church between the north and the south, not just in terms of political context and geographical context, but now in terms of theological context as well. So I said there's two traditions that are forming. And then behind that, you have the geographical context that's taking shape. Northern and southern church, progressive and conservative in both of those arenas. Does that make sense? Are you guys tracking with me? So kind of four streams, if you can think about it that way. But the theological conservatives in the north also are very connected to the theological conservatives in the south in terms of their broader theology. There will be a reunification between the northern and southern church that takes place. It takes all the way until 1983 for the PCUSA to merge with the PCUS. So that mainline denomination, we'll get to what that means in a second, but for a mainline reunification between northern and southern progressives, it takes all the way up until 1983 when the PCUSA really takes assemblage into what you and I would see today, and just even our own context of San Diego, you could see a PCUSA church. That body doesn't really come about until 1983 on a national, broader scale. So I want to look at sort of two divisions, the North and the South, and we're speaking here in theological terms, and we're really going to cover sort of the first half of the 20th century. There's a lot of stuff that takes place in this century, a lot of theological debate and controversy, and what we're going to see is how this really impacts our own church today, not New Life, but the church at large. So three major events take place in the early 20th century in the Northern Presbyterian Church, the Presbyterian Church in the USA. These are the three things, okay? In the 1920s through 30s, we have the fundamentalist modernist controversy. We have the figure of J. Gresham Machen. And then we also have the formation of Westminster Theological Seminary and the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. Those two things sort of come in tandem with one another. So we have the controversy, the figure, and the school and denomination that arise out of the North in the early 20th century. Again, there's the formation of the liberal and conservative divide that's really at the heart of these movements. We start to see the elements that will become progressive Christianity. These are taking place 100 years ago. Some of the questions, you'll see this when we look at the fundamentals that they're arguing for. This sets in motion, sort of, you could say, the chaos that we would see on the opposite side of the church today. We would find ourselves in a conservative church, again, not political, theological, and we affirm these things. And I'm going to say them, and you're like, this is crazy. Of course we believe this. But in the 1920s and 30s, these were the questions that were being asked and ultimately done away with. And we see from that stream a real big theological divide that has really, I'd say, poor consequences for the church. Any questions before I get into some of the... Yeah, Terry. 1920s, 30s, it was fundamental versus what? So it's the fundamentalist-modernist controversy. And there we really have three camps. You have the fundamentalists, and you can't think of fundamentalists in the way that we would use that today in terms of, you would say, a fundamentalist... They'd sort of be stereotyped along the lines of we don't drink, dance, smoke, or watch movies. That's not what we're talking about. So you don't want to import our understanding of what we would consider a fundamentalist back into this era. So you have the fundamentalists, then you have the modernists, and then really you have a big middle, which is called the moderates. And what we'll see is Machen, in his own sort of idiosyncratic way, sort of fails to reach the moderate group and to bring them over into his side. So, yeah, like I said, the term fundamentalist is not what we think it means in our own context. So what is this controversy about? Really, at the end of the day, it's the core fundamentals of the Christian faith. These became known as the five fundamentals, and what was happening on the ground is that presbyteries wanted to examine ministers to ensure that they could affirm these five basic truths. If you think back to this question of confessional subscription, you would have ministers sort of taking in the whole Westminster Standards and saying, this is what I profess and confess to believe is my faith. That the standards sort of faithfully articulate and summarize the core teachings of the Bible. And now what we're seeing is it's basically being reduced to, can you affirm these things? And it's a sad day for the church when this is what they're arguing over. So the first one, the authority and inspiration of the Bible. Is the Bible the inspired word of God? This is the question that's being asked of ministers and churches. Do you believe in the virgin birth of Christ? Is this a real event? Was Christ really born of a virgin? We deal with the atonement. Did Christ's death actually atone for sin? The resurrection. Did Christ really rise from the dead? The miracles of Christ. Did Christ actually perform miracles? What's being asked is asked of ministers is, can you affirm these truths? To Ari, this is crazy in a sense. Of course, we believe in the authority and inspiration of the scriptures. We believe in the virgin birth of Christ and his deity. We believe that Christ provides a real atonement for real sinners. We believe in the bodily resurrection of Christ and that Christ throughout the Gospels actually did perform the miracles that the texts and the Gospel authors record. But this is the theological controversy and landscape of that day. What are other issues at play? There's competing seminaries. As I said, seminaries make up a big portion of the American Presbyterian story. We have Union Theological Seminary in New York, which is a new school seminary. We have Princeton Theological Seminary in New Jersey, the old school seminary, and they're sort of competing in the presbyteries. There's a battleground there for which side is going to win out in this theological controversy. We have Darwinism and the question of evolution. We are now post-Enlightenment, and there's these questions on how do Christians wrestle with Darwin's ideas and the question of evolution. In Europe, you have German higher criticism. Have you guys heard of that before? Critical scholarship, German higher criticism. This is a movement in biblical studies that basically dissects the text in a way that scholars essentially know more than the biblical authors themselves. This is where we see the rise of the basically a splitting apart of the first five books of the Bible to be comprised not of Moses, but of different sources that are comprised and sort of put together after the fact. The text is inherently incoherent and contradictory to itself. That's sort of the scholarship that's taking place in Europe. And what's happening is that scholars in the U.S. are going off and getting their doctorate, they're getting their PhDs in Germany, and they're making their way back to the States, they're teaching in seminaries, and these ideas sort of trickle down in a sense. So they're getting fed from European scholars, and then it's moving into the church in America. One figure in this is Charles Augustus Briggs. It's known as the Briggs Affair, late 19th century controversy over higher criticism in the Old Testament. So what happens here is that basically Briggs wants to go along with this German higher critical stuff. He doesn't want to affirm certain biblical truths. And the General Assembly voted to remove him from his post as the biblical studies scholar at Union Theological Seminary in New York. And the seminary says, that's fine, you can do that, but we're going to now be independent. So the seminary doesn't agree with what the General Assembly did, so Briggs retains his post and position at the university. There's the last sort of generation of the great Princeton theologians. Again, we've said Charles Hodge was a massive figure. I read that quote last week on how he trained more pastors and theologians than anyone else in that era. So Hodge dies. You have his son, A.A. Hodge. You have B.B. Warfield. Again, these are massively influential figures in old Princeton. and they start to fade. They get old, they retire, they die, and that school really now faces a question of identity. Are they going to remain a fixture of the old school, theologically conservative Princeton, or will they be redefined in sort of new school or progressive ideas? And here is where a new young professor makes his way onto the scene, with J. Gresham Machen. So I brought one of his books. I like to do show and tell in this Sunday school. This is a book called Christianity and Liberalism. This is, I would say, a must read for early 20th century works. It's one of Machen's first books. He wrote another book called The Origin of Paul's Religion. He has a new book out that came out recently, a bunch of his radio addresses, which are I have in my office, but I have not yet read. But here, I would say that this would be highly recommended reading. I know we have a copy in the library. It's probably $20 on Amazon. It's short, as you can see. This is a great little read, and I would encourage you to read it. And what he's doing here is he's really attacking and hitting on those issues that are being questioned in the church. And Machen's big argument is that Christianity and liberalism are essentially two different religions. They're not compatible with one another. And he attacks and covers each of those five fundamental doctrines and makes the case for a biblical understanding of what the scriptures teach. Any questions? So I can take a sip of coffee. Machen, M-A-C-H-E-N. No questions? Questions are my favorite thing. Yeah. Yeah, so the question, I'm sorry, what was your name? Jamie. So his question was, is there a crossover between what's being asked here in the Presbyterian Church and other denominations? I think in the 20th century, we start to see that very much so. So on I'm painting with a very broad brush here, but these types of questions are being asked in various different denominational settings. And really what we see in the 20th century is the emergence of what's called the mainline Christianity. So again, the PCUSA, the United Church of Christ, the United Methodist Church, oh, what's the other one? There's five of them. They're called the Five Big Sisters. Keith Scott. ELCA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church Association. Yeah, in America. So you see it in these different different camps, and there emerges out of them basically a broad-scale progressive understanding of Christianity. And we start to see breaks from each of these churches, and each of them have their own unique history with conservative factions breaking off from each of them. In the Lutheran example, we have that mainline church. There are conservative confessional Lutherans. That would be Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. There's a couple other small ones as well. And each of these big denominations have these breaks. And all of them eventually end up in the same place in terms of their theology. So denying some of the core tenets of Christianity, we have the question of homosexuality that starts to play in the latter half of the 20th century, all of which these denominations will end up ordaining for ministry open and practicing homosexuals, as well as the question of women in ministry and that question of ordination. The question kind of goes, women in ordained ministry, then it kind of moves to the question on homosexuality. But each of these denominations, at different timing and different places in the 20th century, eventually end up down that road with small groups breaking off from each of them. Yeah, good question. So this is not a uniquely Presbyterian thing. I'm telling it the story from the Presbyterian perspective and the figures here, but this is happening on a broad scale in the whole 20th century. There's also the question of neo-orthodoxy. That's sort of the term from scholarship that's coming out of Germany, scholarship in the lines of Karl Barth, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Wolfhart Pannenberg, Jürgen Moltmann, these big names in Europe. And it's funny because it's called neo-orthodoxy. It's neither new nor orthodox. So it's kind of an interesting term there. So we see sort of a trickle-down effect from Europe into the theological landscape of the American context. Yeah, good question.
So present day, we're more influenced by 20th century philosophies, maybe out of Germany, that can't go back probably before that.
Mm-hmm.
Were they followers of Lutheran's ideas or what?
No, not really. So the question is kind of a twofold thing. Are the question, I'll re-summarize it, are these ideas still influential in the academy? I would say yes, very much so. If you pick up any commentary on the scriptures, you're going to encounter critical scholarship. Now, not all critical scholarship is bad. Sometimes they have really good insights into the text, but the author might not even be a believer. That doesn't mean they can't make true statements about the scriptures. They just happen to not personally believe in them. And in certain seminaries, you're still being fed some of those German higher critical views, certain philosophical underpinnings that are at play. And that's why the story of seminaries is also equally important as well. Because it's not just as if the denominations are seeing splits. Seminaries are coming and going. Union is still around. I looked at them this week. They still have a seminary there in New York. But you have Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia. You have Reformed Theological Seminary that starts in Jackson starts 1969. And there, they're starting to forge an old school Presbyterian and Reformed Seminary in the South that's carrying on that tradition of the Southern Presbyterian Church. In 1983, you have Westminster Seminary, California, planted out here in San Marcos, and then it moved to Escondido, and then became an independent seminary. Still ties to Westminster, Philadelphia, but separate institutions. You had Fuller Theological Seminary that starts in the middle of the 20th century. The hope there was to sort of forge a new evangelical-associated mainline seminary, and their seminary has completely gone off the rails in terms of their own theological practice. I can say that I went there for a year. So you see these on all these different types of camps, and it's all sort of around these different types of questions. So I think it's very much so still in the water, and it gives us an understanding into how we find our own identity as a confessionally reformed church in the 21st century that's seeking to be giving away the end of this. Faithful to the scriptures, true to the reformed faith, and obedient to the Great Commission. That's the vision for the PCA. Spoiler alert, that's where we're heading. So yeah, good question. Terry?
Say it again.
I'll repeat it in 10 minutes. So I want to cover a little bit of Machen. He's very interesting. Okay, so we see this controversy, fundamentalists, modernists, moderates, taking place. Machen was raised in a very affluent family in Baltimore, Maryland. His dates are 1881 to January 1st, 1937. He studied at Johns Hopkins, Princeton Theological Seminary, and the universities of Marburg and Göttingen, and he's a New Testament scholar. So he has his PhD in New Testament. He joins the faculty at Princeton in 1906. He's ordained to the gospel ministry in 1914. He remains a bachelor his entire life. And he has strong Southern sympathies. So he grew up in Baltimore, which people say is part of the South, but it's confusing for me because it seems Northern. You know? Yeah. So again, I'm just a Southern California kid, so all that stuff back east doesn't make sense to me. So strong Southern sympathies. As I said, he publishes this book, Christianity and Liberalism, in 1923. This is his most influential and probably most important work. And as I said, his basic argument is that biblical Christianity and liberalism are two different religions that cannot coexist. And I'm going to say it again, you should read this book. It still holds up. So what happens? Princeton reorganizes. They take on a much more moderate stance. We see the social gospel. I haven't touched on that yet. The social gospel starts to come into play as well. Have you heard of that term before? Walter Rauschenbusch is a famous proponent of the social gospel. He's a Baptist minister. So this is gaining waves. Protestant liberalism is that European approach. You have guys like Friedrich Schleiermacher and Albrecht Ritschl. These are the big names in the European system, and they're basically promoting a view of Christianity of basically Jesus came to establish a universal religion of brotherly love and affection. They're reducing Christianity down to that basic core principle of brotherly love and affection. So all of this is gaining tide in the Northern Presbyterian Church, and Machen organizes the Independent Board of Foreign Missions. Missions is a major question here too, because what are we going to be exporting? What are we going to be sending out into the mission field? So you have denominations, you have seminaries, you have presbyteries, and you have missions, all asking and pondering the question of what will be the identity of the church going forward. Will it be an identity in progressive, theologically liberal lines, or will it be a church of confessional, biblical lines? Machen is finally booted. In 1929, he would go on to form Westminster Theological Seminary. He takes some young faculty members from Princeton. Cornelius Van Til is one of those, Ned Stonehouse, Paul Woolley, and they start to form. You should go into the library, and Deborah Creedon, our librarian, her dad went to Princeton. No, strike that. Went to Westminster Theological Seminary, and there's an early photo of the professors that he studied under, and they're all in black suits, and you can see, Jim, do you know the date on that? Do you remember? Yeah. So I don't think Machen is dead at that point, but you can see like Ned Stonehouse, Cornelius Van Til, some of these early faculty members. So go check that out in the library and stuff.
There's only one person in the picture
smiling. Who is it?
I don't know.
Oh. Yeah, sounds like a seminary graduation, only one guy smiling. So that sort of taking place. Ultimately, Machen would be tried and suspended from the ministry in 1935. So he holds his ordination in the PCUSA. He starts Westminster in 1929. He's booted, deposed in 1935. And this would be the driving rationale on the formation of the OPC, the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. 6 months after the church's start, Machen would die in Bismarck, North Dakota, raising support for the new denomination. So he dies 6 months after the denomination forms. This is an anecdotal story, and Guy and Carol aren't here. So Mary Peterman, Carol Kemp's mom, the story is, and someone please jump in and correct me, her dad was the one driving Machen in North Dakota. Does that sound right to some of the people who've been here for a while? He was driving Machen around while Machen was in North Dakota. Physically driving, yeah. Driving a car. And he was with him at the time of Machen's passing. So we even see a sort of a familial connection to Machen here. And so this, yeah, Keith. Yeah. 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 So again, these people and these figures are not too distant from our own context. So this story is still one that's very close to home for us. So the OPC starts in 1935, and they split in 1937. This is sort of, I'm saying that a little tongue-in-cheek, but it's funny. They break off in 1937. The Bible Presbyterian Church is that group, that body that broke off. And really the question there, if you look at those five fundamentals, that's what they're wrestling through. And trying to form a confessional Orthodox denomination, if you're just focused on those issues, all of the confessional theology is not yet addressed. If you were in the class last quarter on the Westminster Standards, you'll see that there's so much in our confession of faith that is addressed and worked through, and the Bible Presbyterian Church had a different eschatology, a different hermeneutic of reading Scripture, different views of the covenants, and so those questions weren't addressed because they were fighting over the core fundamentals of the faith, and then it forged a split shortly after its own formation. So infighting already amongst the Reformed. So how does the OPC relate to the PCA? So the OPC, we said in the beginning, there's lots of acronyms. Here's where we start to get a lot of them, okay? The OPC is the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. The PCA is ours, the Presbyterian Church in America. Both would be confessional churches that hold to the teachings and use of the Westminster Standards. Both are part of NAPARC, the North American Presbyterian and Reformed Council. They hold to the same biblical polity of Presbyterianism. There's different regional, demographic, and contextual starts. Remember, the church is still split along northern and southern lines at this point. So the OPC starts out of that northern body, and the PCA starts later out of the southern body. There has been debates and talks over the years about a unification between the two. They got really close, but ultimately there's not been a reunification or a unification, because we were never unified, a unification between the two bodies. So now we get to the southern division. That we'll start today. I have 5 minutes. We'll start today, and this is where we'll pick up next week. So again, we see what's taking place in the north in the 1920s and 30s, and this eventually trickles down and makes its way to the south in the 50s and 60s. And here is where the formation of the PCA starts. So what are the key background issues to this? Well, they're pretty much the same as what had taken place in the north only a few decades prior. The same question of confessional subscription, the same question of progressive theology, the same question of the fundamentals of the faith, and biblical church polity. So that sort of brings us very much a 50,000-foot view into the controversies that are taking shape in the 20th century, that emergence of two streams of Christian thought, one being progressive, one being conservative, and then how different church bodies form in the 20th century. In the north, the OPC, and we'll see next week in the south, the PCA. I covered a lot. So any questions about anything that we've talked about here this morning? Jim.
So the PCA
mm-hmm.
was simply a direct split from the Presbyterian Church USA?
No, the PCUS. So the PCUSA is in the north. After the Civil War, the churches are still split. The country is brought back together, but the church remains divided along northern and southern lines. So Machen breaks out of the PCUSA in the north, and in the south, there's the PCUS, and the PCA breaks out of that body. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Regionally, there was very few, if any, churches. So that's a big thing on the region and demographic of this. The OPC primarily occupies the mid-Atlantic states and has made their way westward, and the PCA primarily occupies the southeast and has made their way westward. So there wasn't necessarily a body that was there, presbyteries that were there, churches that were there. What happens in the 80s is there is the Reformed Presbyterian Church Evangelical Synod is absorbed into the PCA, and that's where we get Covenant College and Covenant Seminary. So there was other groups, and there has been unification. There's been talks between the OPC and PCA, but it's never come to fruition. So different geographical starts and different time starts. So they start in different times in different areas. Yeah, good question. There's some. The PCA is what's called a big tent, and that's a term that we would use to describe ourselves. Theologically, the OPC is much more rigid and dogmatic. Their joke that we make, they would make, is that they're the only perfect church. That's sort of a way to view, a way that they view themselves in that sense. So very, very high emphasis on doctrinal purity in terms of very nitpicky type things. And most of their churches would look fairly similar in terms of the philosophy of worship and the philosophy of ministry. The PCA has a little bit of a bigger tent, and I think that's a good thing and an encouraging thing. We're still all agreed on the fundamentals of theology and the theology of the Westminster Standards, but the philosophy of worship and the philosophy of ministry looks different in different churches. So where I interned at Redeemer, PCA Church, committed gospel-preaching church, gospel-centered church, their worship would look much different than ours. They have contemporary music. They still have all the same elements, but it's a much different liturgy than our liturgy. But the same, we're committed to the same core tenets of theology. Yeah, good question. Yeah.
The Bible Presbyterian.
Mm-hmm.
That's Carl McIntyre.
I think.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. That's a good question. I just don't know. Yeah, Keith, go ahead.
He ended up with the only true church in his old living room. But the original split was over things like tobacco and drinking and the millennium. I mean, he was pre-millennial.
Yeah.
So, you know, he wanted to be a fundamentalist, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's why the term, what I was saying earlier, we don't want to use our understanding of what a fundamentalist is. All the professors would have smoked. They all would have drank. It's not sort of in that teetotaling prohibition type line that modern contemporary fundamentalists would have. So it's a little different of an understanding of the terms along those things. If you got to get kids, go get them. Any other but I'll stick around for if anyone has any other questions. Oh, I didn't answer I didn't come back to it. Okay, we'll hit it next week for sure. So it's true to this. Oh, someone can Google it for me. I should know this. True to the script. Oh, gosh. Faithful to the scriptures, true to the Reformed faith, and obedient to the Great Commission. Took me 3 or 4 tries, but we got there. So that's sort of the mission and vision of the PCA. All righty. Thank you guys so much. We'll see you tonight or next Sunday.